Given the number of funerals it protests and the headlines it draws, you might think Westboro Baptist Church is an enormous enterprise. But the church only claims about 100 members. Almost all of them come from the family of Fred Phelps. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty has this profile of Westboro Baptist and what motivates its members.
They've been called the most hated family in America. The Phelps clan and Westboro Baptist Church first gained notoriety in 1998 when they picketed the funeral of Matthew Shepard, who was murdered because he was gay. Since then, the members have protested at funerals of public figures like Elizabeth Edwards, children killed in bus accidents, and soldiers killed in war. Shirley Phelps Roper, the church spokeswoman, says the members want God to punish Americans for tolerating homosexuality. They picket funerals to make people angry, she says. They want people to reject God and be condemned to hell.
Our job is laid out. We are supposed to blind their eyes, stop up their ears, and harden their hearts so that they cannot see, hear, or understand and be converted and receive salvation.
Westboro's extreme theology sets it apart from any other church, says Mark Potok at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Westboro Baptist Church is an organization that essentially has no friends whatsoever on the far right, the far left, or any place in between.
The Phelpses and their church are isolated in more ways than one. Few news organizations have profiled them. One journalist who did is Bill Sherman, the religion writer for the Tulsa World. He visited them in their compound in an upscale neighborhood of Topeka. He found them polite, normal people, a model of success.
They're college-educated, they're well-spoken. The daughter herself argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. They're not what I expected.
Four of Fred Phelps's 13 children are estranged from the family. Most of the rest live in Topeka and practice law.
They have a very well-respected law firm, and people in town said, well, you know, we don't like them, but if we want to win a case, we'll go to them.
Shirley Phelps Roper says their booming employment and family law practice pays the bills for their travels across the country to publicly shout their anti-gay message. They travel in vans to keep down the costs, which can add up to $200,000 a year. Do they have secret contributors? Phelps Roper is adamant they do not.
We all work, and we all pay our own way. We don't ask for anything from anyone, and we don't take anything from anyone.
The protests are in themselves a source of some income, according to Mark Potok. Over the years, the Phelpses have filed lawsuits against communities that try to stop them from demonstrating.
And as a general matter, they have won. They know their First Amendment rights very well, and they've been very good at defending them.
When they win, they often receive tens of thousands of dollars in court fees, and their winning streak is likely to continue now that the Supreme Court has decided that Westboro's right to free speech trumps the right of families to bury their loved ones undisturbed. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
We have some more celebrity news this morning. Teen heartthrob Justin Bieber just had a good hair day. A very good hair day. We're told that a lock of his hair sold on eBay yesterday for more than $40,000. Mr. Bieber donated his hair in a signed box to the talk show host Ellen DeGeneres, and she then put the clippings on eBay with all the proceeds to benefit an animal rescue charity called the Gentle Barn Foundation.
We had no idea that it would raise this much money. We were speechless.
That's Ellie Lax, founder of the Gentle Barn Foundation. When Mr. Bieber's hair first went on sale, Lax was thrilled to see bidders offering a few thousand dollars.
15 minutes before the bid ended, it was at, I think, $14,000. We were like, wow, that's amazing. And then in 15 minutes, it went from like $14,000 to $40,000.
The winning bidder was not some starstruck teenaged girl, but an online gambling casino called GoldenPalace.com, which collects little bits of pop culture. Here's casino spokesman Drew Black.
GoldenPalace.com has been involved with obtaining odd objects that may strike a chord with the general public. Items that have been collected throughout the years and have raised over $1 million for various charities worldwide.
And if you want to get a sense of the relative value of Bieber hair, $40,000 for Justin Bieber, right? Ellen DeGeneres recently sold a clipping of Elvis Presley's hair for charity for a mere $15,000. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Oh, how you doing? Can you kiss me? Say that.
Republican lawmakers are trying to undo the Obama administration's foreclosure prevention plan. They've introduced legislation to shut down the program, as NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The Obama program was designed to lower interest rates and mortgage payments for struggling homeowners, and it's actually worked for around 600,000 people across the country. But critics say it should be reaching a lot more people.
3.3 million families that might have been reached by this program if only it had been better designed, better managed, and better executed by the Treasury Department.
Neil Barofsky is the special inspector general installed as a watchdog over the government's bank bailout efforts. He spoke at a congressional hearing yesterday. North Carolina Republican Patrick McHenry has just introduced legislation to end the foreclosure prevention plan, which is called the Home Affordable Modification Program. He questioned Barofsky.
Mr. Barofsky, is the 3 to 4 million under the HAMP program, was that the original goal set forward? If you recall,
3 to 4 million was what was originally intended and announced as the number of sustained.
Barofsky has been critical of the Treasury Department for not doing more to make the program work better and reach more people, and also for not offering a current estimate of how many homeowners the program will actually reach now.
It's somewhat shameful that at this point, here we are in March 2011, and the Treasury Department will in one breath say that, well, we know the number is not going to be anywhere close to what we originally said it would be, and then in the second breath, refuse. I mean, this is such a basic failure in transparency, to refuse to tell you what their expectation is as to the total number that are going to receive permanent modifications. It evades accountability, and it's trying to cover up a program that is clearly a failure.
Barofsky and other critics say that one of the program's major weaknesses is that it's a government program, but it relies on the banks to decide who gets help and who doesn't. And they say the banks lose homeowners' paperwork all the time. They reject homeowners from the program when they actually should qualify. The Treasury Department and Barofsky both agree that the banks, or mortgage servicers as they're called, have been doing a terribly inadequate job.
An abysmal job. There's universal agreement to that. But Treasury has done nothing to punish or penalize these servicers.
One of the problems is that the servicers, the banks, often string homeowners along in a way that hurts them. The banks are supposed to tell a homeowner within 3 months whether they qualify for help. But that process can drag on for much longer, sometimes more than a year. And during that time, the homeowner makes smaller payments. But if in the end they get rejected, rightly or wrongly, they suddenly owe a pile of back payments. It can be $5,000 or $10,000 that they can't possibly pay because those smaller payments are then considered inadequate.
They're hit not just with a bill for all of the difference between their trial payments and the amount original done, but late fees. I mean, homeowners are being hit with late fees, and Treasury permits this in their program. Late fees when they've never actually missed a payment.
For its part, the Treasury Department defends the program. It says it's not perfect, but it has helped more than 500,000 people and keeps helping more. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was asked about ending the program this week.
It would cause a huge amount of damage to a very fragile housing market and leave hundreds and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans, without the chance to take advantage of a mortgage modification that would allow them to stay in a home they can afford.
Barofsky, the TARP inspector general, stopped short of calling for the program to be shut down. He has long called for the Treasury to fix it so it will help more people. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Many big city school systems are struggling to close huge budget shortfalls, and that means they're facing wrenching decisions about closing schools, dismissing teachers, and cutting back student programs. Today, we bring you stories from two of those cities.
We begin in Providence, Rhode Island, where teachers gathered yesterday in front of City Hall to protest the dismissal of the city's entire teaching force. Many of those teachers will ultimately be rehired, but the move shows the extreme steps that some districts are taking. Elizabeth Harrison from member station WRNI reports.
Teachers United will never be defeated!
About 1,500 people jammed the street in front of Providence City Hall, raising signs and banging drums in protest. The rally got some added star power from American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten, who calls the terminations insane.
I thought the only insanity was in Wisconsin, not in Rhode Island.
Providence city officials say this is not Wisconsin, but the city is facing an estimated deficit of more than $100 million for the next fiscal year, or roughly 20% of the city budget.
It's unprecedented.
Providence's new mayor, Angel Taveras, says he is considering school closures and layoffs for many city workers. But teachers are feeling the pain first because of a state law that requires districts to notify teachers by March 1st if their jobs are in jeopardy. He says he chose terminations instead of layoffs because it ensures that teachers the city can't afford will be completely removed from the city payroll.
With a layoff, for various reasons, you can be responsible for paying teachers who are not teaching in a classroom. In addition to that, if they go into the substitute pool, you're paying them full pay and benefits, and that's costing an enormous amount of money. I can't allow the taxpayers to be on the hook for paying teachers who are not teaching.
But union leaders point out that the dismissal of 2,000 educators means the city can ignore seniority rights as it restaffs classrooms. Here's Providence Teachers Union President Steve Smith.
By firing all the teachers, the mayor is not solving an educational or a fiscal problem. He is making a political decision to take control and silence workers.
Those workers serve more than 23,000 students in what is by far Rhode Island's largest school district. 80% of Providence students are Hispanic and Black, and many come from low-income families. Like urban districts around the country, Providence struggles with some of the lowest test scores in the state.
Firing the teachers is not going to help, and it's not going to get any better.
As he drops his nephew off at school, Emmanuel Rivas worries that this latest controversy will only make things worse.
Myself, I got 5 nephews that are currently staying with me, and I got 3 that live with me. So what's going to end up happening with them? I mean, they're fired for good. Are they going to go on strike? Beats me, man.
Yet parent Christy Chase sees room for optimism. She says this is an opportunity to end the longstanding practice of giving staffing priority to teachers who have been on the job longer.
This is an unfortunate way to get there, but something drastic does need to be done, and I think this will force the issue of how you evaluate and hire teachers.
Providence city officials say their goal is to cut the budget while doing the best they can for city school children. And they say they will start rescinding some teacher terminations as early as this month. Teachers union leaders say the dismissals are illegal, and they're ready to take this battle all the way to the state Supreme Court. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Harrison in Providence.
Many of you have been clearing your house of baby bottles and other plastic products because they're made with the chemical BPA. Research has shown that BPA can act like the hormone estrogen, at least in mice and in rats. Now, as NPR's John Hamilton reports, a new study finds that even plastics without BPA can release estrogen-like chemicals.
Before you toss out your Tupperware, it's worth noting that scientists still don't know whether people are harmed by any of the chemicals coming from plastics. It's just not clear. And the new study doesn't look at health risks. It simply asks whether common plastic products release estrogen-like chemicals other than BPA. That's something George Bittner, a biologist at the University of Texas in Austin, had been wondering for a long time. So he sent a research team to stores, including Walmart and Whole Foods. Their mission? Buy a whole bunch of stuff made of plastic, the kind of stuff that might come in contact with food.
Baby bottles, deli packaging, flexible bags.
The team came back with more than 450 products. Then Certachem, a testing company that Bittner founded, chopped up pieces of each product and soaked them in either salt water or alcohol to see what leached out. Bittner says the tests made one thing clear.
Most plastic products on the market today release chemicals having easily detectable estrogenic activity.
Estrogenic activity means they act like estrogen. Bittner says about 70% of the stuff the lab tested released these chemicals. And Bittner says that was before they exposed the stuff to real-world conditions, simulated sunlight, dishwashing, and microwaving.
Then you greatly increase the probability that you're going to get chemicals having estrogenic activity released. In fact, maybe somewhere between 95 to 98%.
But what about all those things marketed as BPA-free? You know, dog bowls, bento boxes.
In particular, we've concentrated on baby bottles and water bottles. We've tested them, and all of them have released chemicals having estrogenic activity.
Sometimes even more than products known to contain BPA. The testing doesn't show which chemicals are to blame. That's likely to be frustrating to manufacturers. But Bittner says consumers should be encouraged that at least some plastic products had no estrogen-like activity. He says that shows it can be done. Early reaction to the study was mixed. Some scientists wondered about the test's reliability. Others noted that wine and many vegetables also have estrogenic activity. And they note that Bittner has a financial interest in the testing lab and in a plastics company. But groups that have warned about BPA in the past seem to welcome the new research.
This is really helpful because they took a look at very common products.
Sonia Lunder is from the Environmental Working Group. She says the results suggest the concerns about plastics can't be solved by worried consumers at the checkout counter. It's a problem for government.
Regulatory agencies like the FDA need to study the effects of chemicals leaching out of plastic. We know that EPA first proposed its hormone disruptor screening program 15 years ago and has made virtually no progress.
Lunder says that until there are more definitive answers, worried consumers can follow the old advice to avoid putting those baby bottles in dishwashers or microwaves.
Gee, we've long cautioned consumers to avoid extreme heat and cooling for plastics, to discard scratched and worn plastics, and we feel like this validates one of our many concerns.
The new study appears in the online edition of the journal Environmental Health Perspectives. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered.